Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and today I'm looking for a book about dystopias.
Dystopia.
Not dystopiaries.
We could do a hard pivot into books about topiaries, though.
Okay, I love it.
I got nothing, but I'm sure Joe does.
Yeah, Joe, do you have two books?
I have a class that I teach called Topiaries in the 18th Century.
I don't know if that's a joke or not.
Sounds horrible.
Sounds like a college class you would take.
I think that's offensive to somebody out there.
Alienating our audience, that's what we do.
To help me are my two very good friends, Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, today I am feeling double plus good because I just finished rereading 1984 by George Orwell. It actually kind of makes me feel double plus ungood to reread it.
So nice you did it twice.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a dystopian book, I think you should read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley because it doesn't have complicated jargon like double plus ungood.
Yeah. May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Every time I look at the name Aldous Huxley, in my head I pronounced it as Attalus Huxley. Mm-hmm. Is that just me or is that a common thing?
No, I think everybody does that.
I asked everyone and they said, you're right. You're correct. I'm just being an old fogey here. I will say that Aldous Huxley sounds like a fake name. Like if you were in the 1970s, you went to a seedy motel and you had to put like a fake name in the book.
What year is it?
Nah, 1973, maybe like May of 1973, you might put Aldous Huxley because it seems like kind of a just a made up assortment of sounds.
Can I say this? It's a pretty groovy name. Like, I think 73 is just about the right year. I mean, that is a far out name.
Well,
that and you have to wear bell bottoms.
My dude, Aldous Huxley died purposefully ODing on LSD. So,
wait, really?
Yes, he committed suicide by LSD.
You know what? I just learned that Hemingway killed himself. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I feel like that's something we should have touched on in the Heming episode.
Heming episode.
Let's go back. Like, a lot of family members in Hemingway's tree killed themselves. Like, his dad killed himself, his cousins and shit like that.
Yeah, we talked about the plane crashes just a bit in that episode. And there's a hypothesis that sort of after those, his mental health deteriorated pretty quickly.
Well, that is last week's episode.
Or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, whatever.
Or 3 weeks ago.
That's a heavy fact.
Before I get started, do you guys want to hear a word thing, a really cool word thing I found out recently? It's super fast. You can just take a moment to talk about
it. I love
this.
Word things.
Okay, here's a word thing. So I was one of the wonderful nerdy Twitter accounts I follow is at Haggard Hawks. They tweet weird facts about words, old words, or like old words that have fallen out of use that are interesting and applicable to today, or old meanings for current words. So how long would you guys think a moment is? Like if I say take a moment, how long, like how many seconds do you think that would be?
5 minutes.
Really,
Joe?
Oh, no, I think like 3 to 5 seconds.
Okay. See, that's Joe, that's where I kind of was. I always thought of moments as like not just like a 1 second, but not long, not 5 minutes, my goodness. But apparently, according to Haggard Hawks, and I believe them because they're, you know, scholarly and stuff, the word moment comes from medieval timekeeping, and the people in charge of keeping time in medieval times divided the hour into 40 parts, and a moment was 1/40th of an hour, or exactly 90 seconds. So,
wait a minute. So,
yes,
that's pretty close.
Well, I mean, there is
closer than you guys.
Well, no, I think I was closer than you.
Over a minute.
But when you say take a moment or take a couple of moments, you're saying maybe literally, maybe this isn't how you use it today, but you're saying literally take 90 seconds. So
there you go.
Okay.
That's, but seriously, the reason I brought this up is to just plug Haggard Hawks. It's an amazing Twitter account. And
my grandma always used to say the word dacent. So like she would say, and I love it. I never ever hear it anymore, but I guess the best I could come up with is its meaning is kind of like, I dare not do that. Right. I dare not. So, I dasn't make pea soup. Your grandpa doesn't like it.
So I got no transition for that. Anyway, hey, everybody. This month we are, whether people like it or not, across the nation, we are going back to school. So we thought we'd celebrate that by focusing on the books that Ian and Joe are going to be teaching when they go back to school this year. And so we're still picking themes. So this week is going to be dystopian. Guys, let's do our 30-second plots here.
All right. Yeah. He is, Nick, I do think one of my favorite things every week is the disappointment in your voice when we manage to fill the 30 seconds exactly. Yeah,
it's a good time.
Here's the only thing I know about people.
The only thing? Okay.
Yeah, the only thing I know about people. One of the things I know about people, but this is up there.
How many things do you know about people?
One, at least.
Yeah, at least one.
Okay.
They don't like to see other people succeed. So stop doing well, please. I don't like it.
Your wish is my command.
All right, Joe, in 30 seconds or less, and that is an option. I do want to make that clear. In 30 seconds or less, tell us about your book.
All right, Nick. 1984, written by George Orwell in 1948, is a short, accessible book, and it's vivid enough to get the reader invested in its social commentary. It is the home of many iconic images and phrases, things like newspeak, doublethink, memory hole, big brother, thought crime, and perhaps its biggest contribution to our modern lexicon, Orwellian. George Orwell once said that the best books are those that tell you what you already know. I think this book tells you what you already know, and it is horrifying.
48, 1984, 1973. I'm not going to be able to keep all these dates straight.
There will be a test at the end.
Oh,
just
my
so you
God.
Know.
You're going to have to keep us on track, Joe.
All right. I will start keeping notes on this timeline that I've prepared.
Okay. Thank you.
I got bad news. My summary begins with another date.
Oh, no.
I tell you what, I won't do it. I'll cut out the date.
Yeah,
I'll
thank just... you. Actually, for clarity, if we could just remove all dates from...
Oh, yeah. So this is evergreen, right? We want to be timeless. Exactly. We want people to be listening to this podcast 5,000 years in the future.
Yep.
On the brain tube.
Yep. Okay. Ian.
In the far distant future, the world is at peace, administered by one world government, the world state. John, a young man from a quote-unquote savage reservation in New Mexico, the book's words, not mine, is brought into the world state and struggles with culture shock. Horrified yet seduced by the dehumanizing effects of world state culture, John repeatedly fails to integrate. Finally, overcome with disgust at himself and at the state of the world, he hangs himself.
Wow.
Oh, jeez.
Yes. Okay, well, that is time. Ian, you didn't really say the name of your book or like when it was written. You just kind of spoiled it.
Yeah, well, Brave New World. Probably everyone is super familiar with this now because of the hit TV show on NBC's new streaming service, Peacock.
Can I talk about that real quick?
Oh, I wish you
so
would.
Yeah, I talked to two very different people about this podcast, and one was like, stop talking about classic literature. I don't like it. Like, it's old news. Give me new books. Okay. I don't care. Right?
Cool.
And then I talked to somebody else who's, you know, maybe a little younger and is like, I love all the books you're covering. I kind of remember them from high school. And, you know, I think it's really fun to listen to.
Yeah.
And I think those are the two large camps right now. So I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this, but
the tagline could be, you know, the books you should have read in high school or the books you didn't read in high school.
Ooh, a tagline. That's good.
Yeah,
a
tagline.
Do that.
Yeah. Also, as far as like, it's not called You Don't Know Pop Fiction. It's called You Don't Know Lit.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and we've had conversations about, you know, how do we define literature? What is literature?
I love Joe's definitions of literature. Joe, do you have any definitions of literature today for us?
You know what I do think? I think one of the challenges of defining literature when it's new, right, is you don't know what will become lit or not.
You don't know lit.
You don't know lit. You literally don't know lit. So one of the benefits that Ian and I have when we talk about books written in 1948 or before is they've already been established for us, and we don't have to figure out what New York Times bestseller is going to become the literature of the future.
Well, and a lot of times, like things that are kind of dubbed literature, about 10 years later, everyone's like, actually, no, that's stupid. Or it kind of like falls out of favor. So one that I'm not throwing shade here, but one that Joe has mentioned is Extremely Tall and Incredibly Short or whatever it is.
You got it. Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
And that's one that I remember when it came out, everyone was like, yes, here it is. And since then, it hasn't really like fallen out of favor, but people kind of don't buy it as the literary masterpiece that they thought it was. Some perspective gives them the realization, yeah, it's fine. It's good, maybe. It may be even great, but it's not like as good as we thought it was.
Well, you know, all modern books are so reflective of the moment all the time. And it's so hard to tell what's going to be. It's so hard to tell what's going to happen. What's going to be relevant 10 years from now? What, you know, what do we look on back at from 2003 and care about?
That's enough dates out of you.
I can't wait to see what like COVID fiction will be like. I'm God. Just super fascinated.
A lot of real annoying metaphors, I bet. So before we have Ian redeem himself on his 30-second plot, you'll kick us off. I just want to remind you guys of the show rules here. Number one, only unavoidable spoilers. So we already screwed that up. Omit unnecessary words, Joe.
Yes.
And winning is everything.
Omit needless words.
Needless words. Oh, I should change that.
I saw a copy of E.B. Strunk and White, E.B. White and Strunk and White's Principles, whatever it is. I saw a copy of that book at a book sale, and I deliberately chose not to pick it up.
Okay.
Principles of Style. I said, I know all this. I'm already good at it.
These are needless words.
I said, I pointed at it, and I said, needless words.
And you kept walking. Ian.
Yeah.
Ian.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What book are you presenting?
I'm talking about Brave New World.
Oh, okay,
Aldous Huxley.
Tell us about it.
It gets its title from a Shakespeare play. From a line of Shakespeare. But that's not important.
Way to lead strong.
It's not unrelated.
Let me tell you all the
things that are. It's not unimportant.
Needless information. Okay, so I'll just tell you some things about this book before I tell you about what the book like is, what it's about.
I love it. I love it, Ian. Hey, brilliant. Great. That's a really good idea.
Thank you. Great. Here we go. It was written in 1931 and published in 1932. This is before The Hobbit and before Of Mice and Men, right around the time when the global economies were collapsing, especially in America. But Huxley was British, so he wasn't quite as affected by it as the Americans were, as American literature was. But yeah, it's still happening. This is also the time of Henry Ford. Henry Ford was like dominating sort of production philosophy. So this plays a part in the book. The book is about 300 pages. It is believed by many to be a ripoff of Russian and Polish science fiction. Kurt Vonnegut is one of the ones who thinks that Huxley just read a Polish book and made it his own.
Wait, what? Hold on.
Yep.
Can't necessarily just brush past that one. What do you mean? What book? What was it a ripoff of?
There are a couple of different books that are believed to have been maybe not the source, but Huxley seems to have read a variety of these works of Polish and Russian science fiction published in the teens and 20s, and then he writes Brave New World in the 30s, and people said, hey, those are kind of similar. The question is always like, what are the lines between, on one hand, plagiarism, on the other hand, sort of like homage or engagement with or participation in a convention? I think not having read them, I think that it's likely that Huxley probably took more than he admitted. But I don't know if that's necessarily wrong, because utopia and dystopia are kind of simple. Like,
okay. So do you use this book in your classroom to kind of teach your kids about plagiarism? Like, hey, as long as it's from a different country, you can
right
always
and
steal
wrong.
It.
I make them read the whole thing and say, now don't do that. And then we move on. Never talk about the book. Just
it amazes me how many countries just steal movies from each other. Like, just different cultures. Like, Yep, I'm not going to come up with any examples right
now. Well, here's one. Here's a really
interesting
one. I don't
like to bring knowledge to this podcast.
there was a movie in the early 2000s called Infernal Affairs, which was, I think it was a, it was not American. I can't remember where it was from, but I want to say Hong Kong. I'm not sure. But the point is Infernal Affairs became The Departed and they were both well-respected. But we think of that movie as one that doesn't really have a source, but it does.
I remember when The Hunger Games was at the height of its popularity. A lot of people would say, what? This is just Battle Royale. And right. I think that's a great example of like, it's not plagiarism, it's popularization. Or maybe it's plagiarism. I don't know.
Or the idea like there's nothing new under the sun. Like you can't, they're like somebody said, there are seven plots. Like there are a limited number of things.
I bet it was Shakespeare.
I don't think it was Shakespeare.
There are seven and I wrote them.
Well, it's actually really interesting.
You're welcome.
This isn't a Shakespeare podcast, but the vast majority of Shakespeare's plays were either drawn from or adapted from previous sources. He wrote very few or like purely original stories. Most of his stories were adaptations of other people's work.
Ian's really an apologist for plagiarism, it seems like.
Dealing with Shakespeare and dealing with adaptation, you have to, it's not as simple as just saying, well, that idea resembles that other idea. Plagiarism. I think it's more complicated than that. But I am not plagiarizing my presentation today, by the way. I'm reading this all myself. It's not drawn from anywhere else. In 1967, it was banned in India because it was thought to be pornographic.
Are there pictures in this book?
No, they're not. There are word pictures. Sorry.
Ooh.
Do you really think I would bring a book with pornographic images?
This week, Ian brought porno. Playboy 1984 edition.
Well, it's really interesting because this book, one of the a lot of dystopias really kind of lean heavily into the world building. And one of the ways that this book builds the Brave New World builds its world is by talking about its morality, the society's morality. And one of the cornerstones of this society's morality is everyone belongs to everyone else. So there's no like you don't form lifelong monogamous relationships.
Just to get this out of the way, I actually listened to the audiobook about this book maybe about a year ago.
Okay. How did that go?
Two things stood out to me.
Yes.
Besides it being a very good book. Two things. The first is all of the sex.
Yes.
All of the sex talk. There's a lot of sex talk. There's a lot of that. And then the other thing is how British the voiceover actor was. which I appreciated, by the way. He's a British author. They have a British voiceover actor reading the audiobook.
It's set in England. Yeah.
Yeah. Adds to it.
And it kind of immerses you in the world a little bit, in my opinion. But it's just very British. Very, very British. You could not understand some of the words.
Oh, my sexy goodness. British literature.
Yep. Sexy British literature. So, Ian, sorry to cut you off, but keep telling us about your sexy literature.
Yeah. It's really strange teaching this because I teach it to high schoolers who like my high schoolers were ready for this when we got to it. At the same time, there's always going to be like some kind of giggling, some folks who are kind of like bothered by it because it is, I would not say explicit, but I would say it is frank. It is frank about its discussion of sexuality. There's a lot of kind of disgust in this book. He wrote this book in response to a visit he took to America. He went to America in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, as they're called, and he was kind of grossed out. And so some of the elements of American culture from the 1920s, he incorporated into how he imagined a future dystopia would be, especially in regards towards sort of substance use and sexual morality.
Getting it on.
Yeah, getting it on. He experimented heavily with mescaline and other drugs. And as I mentioned, he did just, he was like, I'm ready to die. I want to overdose on LSD. And he died the same day as JFK and C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia books. So these three guys, JFK, C.S. Lewis, and Aldous Huxley, all died on the same day. But only one of them overdosed on purpose on LSD.
Wow. I didn't know you could overdose on LSD.
That's what I was going to say. How do you do that?
I feel like that's a thing that people say all the time.
I think she just, like, he did it with his wife. His wife, like, helped him. And I think they just blasted him. They blasted him full of it. Just
by the end, he was more LSD than human.
I feel like, did he have some famous last words? I feel like he would have really cool last words.
Oh my goodness. Or terrifying.
Yeah, or just nonsensical. His wife helped him kill himself?
It wasn't like assisted suicide. She was like, she was there. It wasn't,
hey honey, what do you want me to do with this dump truck of LSD? Just put it in the backyard.
I do wish, I mean, he's a creative, inventive author, and his way with words is fascinating. And I really wish I wish it's a bit morbid, but I wish we had like a recording of his final sort of words. I'm sure, like, as he blissed himself to death, I'm sure it was just really a sight to behold.
Wow. Hey, what is the drug in Brave New World called? Refresh my memory.
Soma.
Soma.
Right.
Is that like with an S or a P?
It's an S.
S-O-M-A.
S-O-M-A. Yeah.
Which
so
is a wonderful song by The Strokes.
So
tell us about the book, Ian.
This book is like, so it's kind of like divided into three sections or movements. And like I mentioned, the first priority of this book is world building. So a lot of books about dystopias really get invested in, like, how does this society work? What things have they gotten rid of? What things have they introduced? You know, how intrusive is the government? And so this first section is all about how society functions. The kind of main idea, the main innovation of this book is the world has a caste system. From alpha to epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. So five kind of classes of people, and they are kind of pre-selected before birth into their class with a combination of genetic modification and behavioral conditioning. So using these two sort of strands, nature and nurture, the caste system is set up. And the book, this first section also kind of establishes how people feel about this world state. This is not authoritarian. This is not brutal. This is not crushing. Everyone is happy. Everyone is kind of in a good mood. This is what's called a leisure dystopia. The aim is peace and pleasure and calm. So this is the first section. It's all about, like, what is this world we live in? The book starts by following this guy named Bernard Marx. Bernard Marx is a dissident voice. He's kind of stands out a little bit. And then Bernard goes to a savage reservation, which is an area which has been left kind of away from the influences of the drug and the influences of genetic modification. And he finds this guy named John. And the book kind of switches focus at that point and focuses on John integrating or not in the world state. So kind of a fish out of water story. This guy, he's raised outside this culture, outside this dominant pervasive culture. He's born, he's not genetically engineered. He learns everything he knows about the world from Shakespeare, not from behavioral conditioning. And so he doesn't fit in. He has these unorthodox views. He's kind of seen as this new person. So he's super popular. Bernard Marx abandons his sort of dissident approach because he's just riding John's coattails. He found John. And so he's introducing John to the world. After a while, John kind of gets fed up with all of this attention and the culture in general. He has a long talk with the local kind of government official, the world controller. And the world controller basically says, you don't fit here, but we want you to stay here. And so John goes to live on a farm. He's trying to get back to nature, and he's trying to sort of come to peace, make peace with himself, and find a place for himself, make a place for himself in this world. But people find him, and he's always been this huge kind of attraction. People just come to look at him, a spectacle. They find him on his farm. There's this crisis. He succumbs to the mob mentality. And he kind of catches himself being carried along by this culture. And so when he wakes up from his soma-induced hangover, he hates himself. And so he does kill himself. And this is a spoiler, but I think it's an unavoidable spoiler because the point of this book is he cannot exist in this world. It's a square peg in a round hole. He just can't do it.
I think the coolest thing about this book is the world that the author creates, because it's just incredibly unique.
Right. Yeah. So I've already mentioned the caste system, and people are built to kind of fit into one of these five castes. If you're an Epsilon, you are a laborer and you're conditioned not to be very intelligent and not to be very beautiful. And if you are an Alpha, which is the highest caste, you are a member of the elite. You're intelligent. There's also this really fascinating emphasis on consumption. So as I mentioned, Huxley's writing this around the time that Ford's assembly line philosophy, Henry Ford's assembly line philosophy of material production, is coming into the forefront of sort of production philosophy. And Huxley sort of elevates Ford in this future world. He says, Ford is God, basically. People look up to Ford like Ford is a deity that is whose ideas are inspired. And so everything is about making, creating, and consuming. And the world controller, this sort of authority figure, actually says, one of the ways we keep people sort of sedate and calm is making things for them to buy, making things for them to consume, and then they run out. And then there's also the issue of the drug. Like this drug is very pervasive. It seems maybe not particularly addictive, but it is powerful. And everyone takes Soma. Soma makes you calm. Soma makes you peaceful. Soma can come in little pill form. There's a scene where some people are kind of, some Epsilons are sort of squabbling, and they get Soma gas sprayed at them. They inhale it and they become calm. But this is absolutely normalized, and it's not even recreational.
When you say everybody is happy in Brave New World, are they happy because of Soma, or are they happy because all of their needs and desires are provided for and Soma's just the icing on the cake?
I think the world state would say everyone's happy because their needs are provided for. There's no want. There's no pain. There's no... So the world state would say people are happy, truly happy. But I think the question, one of the questions that this book raises is, are they actually really happy, or are they just drugged? Are they just sort of their spirits are dampened by the drug, by Soma itself, and as well as by this constant consumption? And Huxley is very, very clever in doing this. But the thing is, the question is like, happy. What does happy mean? And this is a question that John the Savage brings up. John says, you guys aren't happy. You're drugged, basically. And the world controller is like, well, that's a point of view. That's just your perspective. I think Huxley intends for us not to buy it. Like I think this is a dystopia. This is not a utopia. It's not saying people are actually happy. But I think it's one of those weird dystopias where you're not sure, where the book asks you to think about, is this actually good or is this actually bad? And I think, unlike some other books we'll be hearing about on this episode, it's unclear. And I think there have been people who have said, well, maybe Huxley was onto something. Maybe, you know, maybe it's not all bad.
I mean, you call it a dystopia, but it's only a dystopia because our main character is unhappy. Like, nobody else really talks about that. I mean, there are pills for food, right? There, people have sex constantly to satisfy that need. Like, the whole point of the book is that every need, every human physical need
desire,
is satisfied.
Every desire is what it says.
Every
like.
Desire is satisfied.
Right.
So in a sense, it paints this picture of this utopia. But it's not.
Well, and this is a question. This is a question I ask my students. Is it a utopia? So they've basically done away with history. There's no need for history anymore. We're focused. There's no need to look back anywhere beyond Henry Ford. Like, Henry Ford is history. Everything else just doesn't really matter. Religion taken care of. That there are very carefully circumscribed religious ceremonies. You do them, it's fine. Everything is right there at your fingertips. And I think the question that Huxley asks is, are these people human anymore? Like, are they so given over to sort of their desires and everything is being instant gratification that there's no sense of humanity anymore? Yeah. So there's one character who just consumes. She's just like, this is the main female character, Lenina Crown. She just kind of she consumes the things that she has available to her. And she doesn't really often sort of ask herself hard questions. And I think about the world around her. She thinks she lives in a utopia. All these people think they live in a utopia, except for maybe a couple of them. And that's the question. I think it's a really fascinating approach to a dystopia to say, what if there were a dystopia that no one knew was dystopian? Nobody realized that they were living in this sort of oppressive society. And the question is, like, what is oppression? What are the extents of oppression?
It doesn't seem that bad.
Yeah.
As I read this book, I'm like, this seems okay.
This society could go forward. This society could, like, propagate itself and continue. I think the concern that Huxley has about this sort of society is, does it sap the people of their humanity?
Yeah. So I think that's a really, I'm going to say it's a pessimistic view of humanity. Cause if you ask people what they want, they say, we want to be happy. Right? Like if you ask, how do you know you're successful? I know I'm successful if I'm leading a happy life, right? And here, it sounds like what Huxley is saying is, hey, there's something very human about suffering. And there's something very human about being unhappy. And you cannot fulfill your human experience unless you're miserable for a large part of it.
or at least have the option to be miserable. I think that's right. You got to remember, Huxley's writing about a decade after World War One. And so he has seen kind of a world where, like, misery is the dominant.
It's like that classic view of what the future is going to look like, and like being terrified about, like, well, where's the joy in, you know, earning these things?
Right. Well, we were talking offline about boats and how people buying boats.
As we do.
That's most of our conversations. And I think a lot of times, sort of these big leisure purchases, a lot of times, like, you earn it, right? You build up to, you save money for that or whatever. I think there's a sense that we feel, and maybe we're wrong, that happiness has to be earned. Happiness has to be the product of, like, drudgery and maybe even suffering. And the question of what happens when you just can have it.
Why do you teach this book?
Because I have to. No, it's on the curriculum, and I think it's worth reading. A lot of dystopia invites us to sort of draw conclusions about society. My students love to do this. Like, you play this game with dystopia. So where are we similar? Like, this is the thing you do. How are we Brave New World? How are we 1984? And by the way, I'll just note that Aldous Huxley wrote a letter to George Orwell. And he was like, Orwell, you fool, you're wrong. He said Huxley thought that Brave New World was more realistic and more likely to come true than 1984. He said, I believe within the next generation that the world's rulers will discover that infant conditioning and hypnosis are more efficient as instruments of government than clubs and prisons, and that the lust for power can be just as completely satisfied by suggesting people into loving their servitude as by flogging and kicking them into obedience. In other words, I feel the nightmare of 1984 is designed to modulate into the nightmare of a world having more resemblance to that which I imagined in Brave New World. So he thinks that he's like, I'm right and you're wrong. He sees sort of the march of society as moving more in a Brave New World direction than 1984. And I think that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure where I would come down on that.
I think it's a fun book.
Well, that sounds depressing to me.
It did. Ian, you really made it sound pretty depressing. I think it's such a fun book. It's such a fun read. It's pretty unique in the world that it builds. But you're out of time, so.
Okay.
Ian, when you teach this to your students, do they think it's a fun book or do they think it's a depressing book?
It's really fascinating. So
depends how old you are when you read it.
I do think there's a level of world weariness which makes it more. I think that up through about maybe two-thirds of the way through the book, it's pretty fun.
Like,
you're along for the ride. You're like, this is really cool, this is really interesting, I'm interested to see where this goes. And then there's, like, I ask my students, like, where they think it's going to go at a certain point in the book. There's a kind of a turning point where it's something's going to have to happen. And I asked them, like, what do you think is going to happen? And around this point, they start to realize, oh,
yeah,
this is not going to end well. For our main character. Like, it's a rut-row moment. Like, up until that, I would agree, Nick, up until that point, it's engrossing, and it's still engrossing after. Up until that point, it's almost a ride. It's a fun ride to get to that point. But then when you start to see, like, this is not going to work out, and this society is going to chew up John Savage and spit him out, and he's going to not work here. That's kind of a downer, and you see it coming. Like, you know, after a certain point, you're like, there is no way this is going to end well for him. Did you think this, the end of this book was fun?
Great question.
Well, I'm an optimistic, Ian. So, like, you know, you look at the entire world and just didn't work for one guy. That's pretty good numbers. That's much better than our situation, because it's not working for a lot more than one right now.
Oh, goodness.
So I'd say big improvement.
So as I'm listening to Ian, I'm really struck by how many parallels our books have to each other. Like, I think there are tons of parallels between these two books, which in a lot of ways shouldn't be surprising. But as you're talking about this unimpeachable authority in Ford, like, I would say I have an unimpeachable authority in Big Brother. When you talk about history being eliminated because it doesn't matter anymore, in 1984, history is actively revised. We have this caste system in both books. Both end on incredibly, despite what Nick says, pessimistic notes. Yeah. And I think it's, I've never read Brave New World, but I'm struck by the similarities in hearing your discussion. Nick, I've got some fun facts about the author.
Thank God. Who's the author?
The author is George Orwell, but the first fun fact is that is a pen name. His name is not George Orwell.
Are you serious? I had no idea.
His name is Eric Arthur Blair, which is also a very British sounding name.
Yeah.
He adopted the name George Orwell because one of the first pieces of writing, he was born into this aristocratic, kind of imperial family. Like, his father was involved in the opium trade in India. He was like of the imperial class in India. And as he got a little bit older, he did what he called some tramping about, which, like, he went and lived in Paris. He was, like, kind of homeless for a little while. At one point, he was trying to write about what poverty looked like, so he tried to get himself arrested. And when he was trying to publish this account, he didn't want to embarrass his family, so he didn't want to write under his actual name. So instead, he adopted the name George Orwell because it sounded like a super British name. His word for it was a good round English name. So, George Orwell.
Well, and also, like, you don't want to be called George or poorly, because
no,
you got to be Orwell.
Wait, what?
I'm making it's a joke between the contrast of Orwell and or poorly. I would say it was not my best effort. Anyway, as you were saying, Joe.
Yeah. Nick, George Orwell had knuckle tattoos.
Great. Next fact.
Yeah, all right. I thought you'd
wait. No.
What did they say? It's got to be four letters.
Yeah, they actually didn't say anything. It was just a series of dots on his knuckles that he got while he was working, again, in the imperial class as a police officer in Burma. And he did it to kind of show solidarity with the people that he was policing. It was kind of a local tradition that men would get these tattoos, these dots on their knuckles. So Orwell did it as well. Really, a little bit of cultural appropriation, I suppose. But yes, he had knuckle tattoos. Ian.
It's pretty badass.
George Orwell and Aldous Huxley knew each other, as you know.
Yes, they did.
Aldous Huxley was George Orwell's French teacher when George Orwell was in boarding school. During World War II, he was working as a reporter in London, and his house was struck by a German rocket. The manuscript for Animal Farm was inside. Mm-hmm. And at lunch, he went back to his house and sifted through the rubble until he found his manuscript for Animal Farm, which of course would go on to become a classic.
Talking animal book.
Why didn't you guys bring that one?
Two more fun facts.
Two more.
On his deathbed.
He died of tuberculosis.
Ah, yeah. That's my final fun fact. On his deathbed, he snitched on a bunch of communist-leaning artists, writers, and actors in 1949. Oh. This includes Charlie Chaplin.
What?
So,
no!
So
George!
He named names what? On his deathbed. And finally, he died of tuberculosis, which is my final fun fact. But the fact isn't that he died of tuberculosis. He died of tuberculosis even though a cure existed. The problem is that he was allergic to the cure. Oh. And when he would take this medication, he had like severe reactions to it, including all of his hair falling out. So he stopped taking the medication and died.
Sounds like the end of his life was pretty bad. Pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of went out like a bitch, huh? He named names and then just
Charlie
refused
Chaplin?
To take his medicine.
Come on.
Nick, let me tell you a little bit about what 1984 is about.
Thank God. Save us.
The bull by the horns.
That's right. So 1984 follows this guy named Winston Smith. Winston Smith is a mid-level government bureaucrat. And his specific job is he works in a ministry that is in charge of altering the past so that it lines up with the current stance and current predictions of the party.
You just said a real mouthful there.
Yeah,
you
let
just
me give
say
you an
that
example
again.
Of this.
Say yep. that so, again. Yeah, or so, give us an example.
So Winston Smith works over what he calls a memory hole, or what's called a memory hole. And what will happen?
Is that what he calls his brain?
Yeah, I was gonna say that's what that, that's mean? My that's my name for my brain on Monday morning.
So what happens is, for example, the party, like the all-knowing, all-powerful party at the center of the society in this dystopia, will make a prediction like it's going to rain tomorrow. And then the next day will come and it will be sunny out. So what the party then does is they send information to this department that Winston works in, and Winston's responsible for changing the weather forecast from yesterday so that the party was correct about it. So if you ever look back in time, if you ever look back at yesterday's newspaper or last month's newspaper, all of the party's predictions, all of the party's biases, all of the party's vendettas are correct. The party is never seen to be fallible.
Sweet.
And that's his job. So he will go back, he'll rewrite the weather forecast from yesterday, or he'll rewrite the boot orders, you know, how many boots are going to be manufactured, or even like what nation we're at war with. He'll rewrite all of that stuff and then destroy the original document. He drops it into this memory hole in which it just goes into an incinerator.
It seems like a lot of like authority for one person to have. Like
master of information here.
Winston Churchill were to go rogue, he could burn down the whole house.
He is in a bureaucracy, it should be understood. So he is one of many, many, many people that do his job. There are checks, there are balances, there's QC that makes sure that he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. But Winston takes pride in his job, and he thinks that he's better at it than most people. So, for example, if the party predicts that next quarter we're going to make 1 million boots for our soldiers, and in reality they make 500,000 boots for our soldiers, Winston will go back and he will edit their initial prediction, not to 500,000 boots, but to 350,000 boots, so that the party can say we surpassed our prediction, right? Like we were even greater than we anticipated.
And you're saying this is a good thing?
No, I'm saying this is a horrible thing. This is a dystopian novel.
But it's good to take pride in your work.
Absolutely.
Whatever that may be.
Take pride? Does he take pride in his work?
Sounds
so,
like it.
First, yeah, like when we first meet Winston, he is he's kind of just getting by as a member of the party, right? And when we talk about the party, I guess we need to understand that there is an inner party, like the people who are actually pulling the strings and the people who are actually in control of society. There's an outer party of which Winston is a part of, and these are the people that do the work for the party, the bureaucracy. And then there's the proles. The proletariat proles are exactly what you think they are. They are poor. They're not particularly interested in party politics. They're just kind of interested in getting by, putting food on the table, etc.
What's the premise of this book?
Yep. So what happens is early in the book, Winston, he's good at his job. He's a relatively loyal member of the party. But even early in the book, he feels like something is wrong. He feels like something is amiss. And he understands by the nature of his job that like he is altering history, and he feels like there's something kind of skeezy about that, right? And as the book goes on, he rebels at first in really, really small ways. Things that would still have been
instead of 350 is 325.
Well, he rebels at first in ways like he'll visit an antique shop, right? Which is, ooh, of course, this
edgy.
Yeah, like it's this. It's of course like this super.
He wouldn't
small
use
thing
a coaster.
Oh man, what a punk!
But as the book goes on, he rebels in slightly bigger ways, slightly bigger ways, slightly bigger ways. And then, like happens to so many of us, he meets a woman and everything goes to hell, right?
Oh, I can't. Whoa. I'm not sure I'm going to sign up on that one.
No, he meets a woman who is similarly rebellious, but much more headstrong than he is, but much more like adamant about it than he is.
Okay, can I stop you there? If I were watching this movie, I would immediately suspect her of being a double agent.
Of course, and you do suspect her of being a double agent. Ian, you're obviously familiar with the phrase, methinks he doth, methinks something
the lady doth protest too much, methinks. Yes, that
thank
one.
Thank you. That's exactly what it is, right? Like
famous
she,
quote by Yoda.
She loves the party, and to all outward appearances, she is like the embodiment of what the party expects out of these young women. She is androgynous, which is very desirable. She wears this sash that signifies her as a member of the anti-sex league, because of course young people shouldn't be having sex, all these super desirable things, but in her heart she is a traitor.
What?
Oh, so she actually is. Okay.
Yeah. What?
Because it seems like, okay, what, when you're sort of dissident, when your dissident hero meets somebody who is also dissident, I would suspect that person of like pretending to be dissatisfied, espionage, but in fact they're actually like set up to, it's a sting operation, but it sounds like he actually finds a soulmate.
Yeah, they do. He finds this.
Is this a love
soulmate
story, Joe?
Well, for a while. So he meets this girl, and they do everything they can to live life outside of this totalitarian madness.
Would you say that they're square pegs in a round hole, and they're forced to fit?
Yeah. So I guess there's so many interesting things to talk about in this book, but we, similar to Brave New World, we definitely have Winston as this square peg in this round hole, right? He does not, he rejects the society that he's inside of. This, it just so happens that he lives in a society in which, in order to reject it, is incredibly dangerous. One of the worst things you can be branded as is a thought criminal. And that means that even to think a thought against the party is a crime worthy of being disappeared, right? A crime worthy of becoming an unperson, as they would say here. If I'm saying you should read this book, there's three main areas that I think that I loved about this book that I would like to pass on. One of the interesting things that happens in this book is how the party controls the population. So one of the worst things you can be in this society is a thought criminal, right? And that means that the party has to have ways of controlling and monitoring what people think. How the party controls the population, and they do it through all the traditional dystopian ways. They monitor the population. Everybody's home has a telescreen inside of it. Public places have telescreens inside that both give the content of the day. They give the news, they give the weather, they give the, you know, bulletins about whatever the current emergency is in the nation, but they also watch you and they monitor your behavior and they make sure that you are doing your nightly calisthenics routines and that you aren't reading books or writing or doing anything dangerous like that.
That's where Big Brother comes from.
So Big Brother is this entity that is supposedly always watching you. And there's propaganda posters all over town that say Big Brother is watching, right? With this man's face, with this mustachioed man's face on it, looking at you in this way that the eyes follow you wherever you move.
Like a painting. Why is it called Big Brother?
Because he's just looking out for your well-being. He just wants what's best for you.
Which is the very literal. Okay.
I'm sensing a trend. Did Orwell hate mustaches? Because this man has a mustache. Charlie Chaplin had a mustache. I
thought that too. But Orwell also has a mustache.
Crap.
Oh, darn.
My theory fell apart, guys. I'm sorry.
Is he interested in like kicking over the party, or does he just want to live his life free of influence? Is he like is he a provocateur, or is he just like, I'm out.
Does he want to go live as a savage?
Yeah, precisely.
He believes that the party can't be overthrown. So what he's most interested in is in what small things can we do in order to preserve some semblance of control over our own lives, right? And that could be things like going to an antique shop and holding on, buying this really concrete remnant, this concrete reminder of the past. It could be things like writing in a journal outside of the eyes of the telescreen. It could be things like meeting his girlfriend for clandestine sex meetings out in a meadow, right? Like, it could be all these different things. But he's so interested in just preserving this little flicker of human spirit, like this little flicker of a rejection of the party doctrine.
These books are incredibly similar. Are these almost the exact same books?
No, I don't
Maybe
think so. Because
Huxley just stole this book too.
Well, this book is after.
I think Huxley wouldn't say that power is its own end. I think the book, the world state in Brave New World is interested in peace. So this sort of society grows out of a really bitter, long war. And so they are doing whatever they can to keep people peaceful. And they believe that they can do that by staying in power, but it's not all about like, let us have control because we like it. It's more about like, let's do what it takes to keep people from fighting each other.
And on the flip side, Big Brother and the party, they keep people in subjugation through this atmosphere of constant war. There are basically three super states in this nation or in this world, and they are constantly at war with one another. And whoever
Minnesota,
is the,
and, Wisconsin and Illinois.
And whoever's the bad guy of the moment is the bad guy of all time, right? And the people are kept in check by fear of this outsider, by fear of this bad guy. Yeah.
Like, we've always been at war with so-and-so, even though people can remember 2 days ago we were actually at war with the other guys.
Exactly.
So that's how they control.
Like, we've always...
So what happens, Joe? Does it all come apart at the end?
Well, I don't want to talk so much about what happens. In fact...
Because that was a test about spoilers, and you passed.
I want to talk instead about parallels that we see to our society today, right? Ooh. And I just want to...
Here we go. Spill that tea.
All right, give me some, because I was over at your house recently, Joe, and I noticed that you had coasters on your table, and I want you to know I did use them. So
thank you. I appreciate that. You know who appreciates that more is my wife.
Big brother-in-law's always watching.
That's good.
So
good.
They live in this world of constant surveillance in which every citizen.
Oh, Joe's my brother-in-law. That was the joke.
Right. I think to be made.
Well, I know that you got it, Joe, because you're my brother-in-law.
Sure.
I do fear that, yeah, we didn't say that. So that was important context.
The only reason that we let Nick do this is because he's related to Joe.
Yes.
I feel like the Litheads could have listened diligently to every episode we have and know absolutely nothing about any of us.
That's the goal.
This is the long game.
First rule of podcasting is be faceless. Don't have a personality. Anyway, you were saying.
So in the world of Big Brother, we live in a world of constant surveillance. That is not totally unlike the things that we get leaked for about the NSA watching citizens or tapping into your phone microphones, etc. In the world of Big Brother, every day we get these 2 minutes of hate. And the 2 minutes of hate are when the party, everybody stops what they're doing. And the party throws up on the telescreen whoever the enemy of the moment is. And sometimes that's East Asia, sometimes that's Eurasia, but it's always Emmanuel Goldstein. And Emmanuel Goldstein is a separatist leader inside of the party. Like, he's this guy who was once part of the inner party. He broke away. So they'll throw Goldstein on the screen, and people just like boo and jeer and throw things at the screen for these 2 minutes. And at the end of those 2 minutes, your time is over and you go back to doing what you were doing. But it's this idea of constantly reminding us who the enemy is. It's this constant fear of the other. And we can see this through, we can think of our war on terrorism. We can think of the Islamic flight ban. We can think of Donald Trump and the bad hombres at the border, right? Like, it's this constant fear of the other to keep people in, to essentially have people want the party to control and keep them safe.
You want a one-star review?
Go ahead. 1-star review.
All right. Now, this is going to be tough to refute.
Oh, boy.
And it was honestly one of the first things that popped up into my mind when you said you were going to share this book today. And this 1-star review, it seems to have captured it perfectly. All right. So 1-star review from Cameron. I don't think this should have been published in 1949. They should have waited until 1984 because it's titled that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 1-star.
That's tough to argue against.
It is frustrating when that doesn't happen.
And they could have, or they could have just kind of held off and waited until whenever the new Wonder Woman movie comes out, because it's about 1984 too. So, you know.
Is that called 1984?
It's a tie-in. Like, I think this is probably a tie-in novel, like the novelization of that film. So, like, why? What gives?
Is she going to go back and fight Big Brother?
I think she is Big Brother. It turns out the Big Brother is actually Big Sister.
She's going to go back and find her Big Brother.
No, she is. She is the one. It turns out she's a villain. She's been watching everyone. It's like, no, Wonder Woman, we thought you were.
Oh, shit. Wait, is she going to go back and, like, befriend somebody? What's the female's name in your book, Joe?
I definitely know that.
Clearly important. Boy. That's one thing. That's another parallel. We're talking about parallels between our books. This both of these books they seem more interested in the male experience under dystopia rather than the female experience. More like, what's it like to be a guy in dystopia rather than
Julia. I would like to point out, Wonder Woman. It is very hard to Google who is the female in Big Brother because, of course, Big Brother is a television show. Was a television show. I don't know if it still is or not.
Right.
They're on like season 85.
Yeah.
I think they do like 5 seasons a year, though. So.
Okay. That makes sense. So you're saying that this this book, its biggest impact on society is the reality TV show Big Brother.
That is its biggest legacy. Yes.
Okay.
I think it's a little bit dangerous for a lot. So 1984 has had this sort of cultural impact, not just with the sort of Big Brother idea, figure of speech, but also like language, like thought crime. He uses language in interesting ways in this book because the government is the party is in control of language too. But I kind of think it's not super great when these things become punchlines, when, elements that are intended to be kind of cautionary in Orwell's book become sort of jokes. So like the Big Brother TV show, one of the conceits of that show is there are cameras everywhere, but it's like, it's a good thing because we can see these weird people doing their horrible stuff or whatever. Like that's the point of Big Brother. Like being able to watch everyone all the time is good. It makes the show possible.
I mean, yeah, but we also get, you know, I think, I mean, maybe you haven't done this, but I know my wife and I will frequently be talking about something and we will like, and we'll joke, well, are our cell phones around? Maybe we should cover them up, right? You know, like Big Brother is listening. And that's like a joke, but it's also kind of like, haha, but sort of, it is something to be aware of, right? And it's this crazy line to walk, I think.
Right.
Okay. I think one of the most interesting connections to modern day that this book has is this idea of editing the past and memory holes. And when I read this, you can't help but think of Trumpism. Like when you think of this like authority who's like defying who's like denying the past and rewriting history as we go, like you absolutely can't help but think of politics, right? One of the hot takes that I saw on this, or one of the takes that I was surprised by, is they talked about this idea of memory holes. And how more often than not, we don't have some central authority going back and editing the past. We are editing our own past all the time in the name of political correctness, in the name of social justice, in the name of whatever. And I thought it was such an interesting take. It had never crossed my mind. But we think about things like, you know, the Washington Redskins recently announced that they'd be losing the name Redskin for next year.
Why?
Yeah, right. Like why? Who knows? That's obviously like a huge celebration for a lot of people on this planet. But also, like, don't we lose a little bit of something about the past? And some of what I'm about to say is going to be, I don't want to get canceled.
Statues, Joe.
So, I mean, tearing down statues is the exact same idea, right? Where it's like, hey,
I don't know if I agree with you.
Yeah, we can tear down Confederate statues, but like, aren't we kind of ignoring something about the past when we do that? When we delete our old social media posts, right? Maybe you have social media posts of yourself in blackface. Maybe you just want to delete pictures of you and that girl that you used to date, right? But you are always constantly revising the past, revising your own story. And I think it's, I don't know, it really made me wonder if we lose something when we do these things, right?
Like, I think
if
we're being
dishonest. Yeah, go ahead.
I think there's a difference, though, between removing something that might hurt people and pretending that thing never existed. So there is a pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers, or he was last year, I'm not sure if he still is, who did some racist tweets when he was young. He deleted those tweets. The fact is...
Smart.
The fact is that he was saying racist things when he was young. Right. Him deleting those tweets is not necessarily saying I was never racist. Him deleting those tweets is saying this is not who I am now. I'm not keeping these tweets as part of my public persona. I think statues are the same way, where there's a difference between removing a statue and saying that statue never existed. It sounds like what the government, what the party's doing here is saying, no, we were always at war with so-and-so. Mm-hmm. That's different from saying we are no longer at war with so-and-so.
Right. We've revised our opinion on East Asia.
I think removing unpleasant things, sort of editing our history, is as long as we acknowledge that we used to be called the Washington Redskins, it's okay to be called something else. If we start saying, no, we've always been called the Washington Beatboxers, it's always been us, that's a problem. But when we just take away the thing that might be hurtful, maybe we even acknowledge this is hurtful, so we're not going to call ourselves that anymore. That's different from saying, no, we have always, always been completely cool, completely chill, not racist or sexist at all. We're great.
But also, like, when you get this guy deleting his old racist tweets and saying, like, well, that's who I was, it's not who I am, or I was this dumb kid, you know, saying dumb stuff, right? I also feel like that's not something we willingly acknowledge and willingly point out until we are called out on it, right?
Oh,
like,
sure,
until somebody 100%. Says, hey, didn't you used to have a bunch of blackface pictures on your Instagram, right? Like, right. We don't say, hey, guys, really I'm cleaning up my phase. Instagram. Yeah, I was going through a phase.
Yeah, to Ian's point, I think there's some nuance there. Joe, do you want to revise what you said? Sound like a racist?
go back. And...
Would you like to revise your history 4 minutes ago? No, I get what you're saying. I think it's the first time in history that we are looking at our history, if that makes sense. American history.
Maybe.
In this way. I think
the
amount of knowledge
that is
available to people, this is the first time that people are looking at their history and saying, ooh, maybe we should not celebrate our history, or maybe we should think about what our history is and what aspects of it we need to be celebrating and teaching and having statues of.
Emphasize different aspects. Like, there's been a push to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. And the more I learn about Harriet Tubman, the more I think she was the leader of the Underground Railroad. The more I learned about her, the more like awesome and cool she is. And I never really learned. I knew Harriet Tubman, Underground Railroad. That was it. But like, she was in danger. She was running and being chased. She like carried a gun in her dress so she could shoot at people who were chasing her. She was awesome. But like, we don't prioritize this. We haven't. And so then that's not, it's allowing us to realize what elements of our history we should be putting more focus on.
Hey,
great.
I want to be on the right side of history. So Ian, you win. So Ian, thank you so much for bringing this book. I think people should read this book. I've read it before, so it's not completely new for me, but I would pick it up again and read it from time to time, because I think it's really interesting. And I think it's a pretty rich world that you would get a lot more out of it the more times you read it.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of things you brush past and a lot of things that, because it just puts you in the middle of the world. No, not you. I just mean as a reader. Like, there's a lot of things that you just, like, you have to accept. Like, there's terminology, there is dynamic that is incredibly complex.
Right. Yeah, there's every time I've taught it, I feel like I teach it better. The next time I teach it, because I'm like, oh, this is connected to this. This thing is a reference to this. It is very rich.
Give us a quote, because I need to go.
Okay, this is kind of the climax of John Savage's Voyage of Discovery. He's talking to the world controller. There are 9 world controllers. So this is and that's it. That's the top level of government. So this is a pretty big deal. And John says, I like the inconveniences. We don't, said the controller. We prefer to do things comfortably. But I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. In fact, said Mustafa Mond, the controller, you're claiming the right to be unhappy. All right then, said the savage defiantly. I'm claiming the right to be unhappy. Not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind. There was a long silence. I claim them all, said the savage at last. Mustafa Mond shrugged his shoulders. You're welcome to them, he said.